Owen paled before Richard's glare.
Nothing is real. We can't know if what we see, if anything, is real or not. How could we?
If you see it, then how can you possibly think it isn't real?
Because our senses all the time distort the truth of reality and deceive us. Our senses only delude us into the illusions of certainty.
We can't see at night. Our sight tells us that the night is empty. But an owl can snatch up a mouse that with our eyes we couldn't sense was there.
Our reality says the mouse didn't exist,
yet we know it must in spite of what our vision tells us, that another reality exists outside our experience.
Our sight, rather than revealing truth, hides the truth from us. Worse, it gives us a false idea of reality.
Our senses deceived us.
Dogs can smell a world of things we can't because our senses are so limited.
How can a dog track something we can't smell if our senses tell us what is real and what isn't?
Our understanding of reality, rather than being enhanced by, is instead limited by our flawed senses.
Our bias causes us to mistakenly think we know what is unknowable, don't you see?
We aren't equipped with adequate senses to know the true nature of reality, what is real and what isn't.
We only know a tiny sampling of the world around us.
There is a whole world hidden from us, a whole world of mysteries we don't see, but it's there just the same, whether we see it or not, whether we have the wisdom to admit our inadequacies to the task of knowing reality or not.
What we think we know is actually unknowable. Nothing is real.
Richard leaned down. You saw those bodies because they were real.
What we see is only an apparent reality, mere appearances, a self-imposed illusion all based on our flawed perception. Nothing is real.
You didn't like what you saw, so you chose instead to say it isn't real?
I can't say what's real, neither can you. To say otherwise is unenlightened arrogance.
A truly enlightened man admits his woeful ineffectiveness when confronting his existence.
Richard pulled Owen closer. Such whimsy can only bring you to a life of misery and quaking fear, a life wasted and never really lived. You had better start using your mind for its true purpose of knowing the world around you instead of abandoning it to faith in irrational notions. With me, you will confine yourself to the facts of the world we live in, not fanciful daydreams as concocted by others.
Jensen tugged on Richard's sleeve, pulling him back to hear her as she whispered,
Richard, what if Owen is right? Not necessarily about the bodies, but about the general idea.
You mean you think his conclusions are all wrong, and yet somehow the convoluted idea behind them must be right?
Well, no, but what if what he says is really true? After all, look at you and me. Remember the conversation we had a while back? The one where you were explaining how I was born without eyes to see?
She glanced briefly at Owen and apparently abbreviated what she had intended to say.
Certain things? Remember that you said that for me, such things don't exist? That reality is different for me? That my reality is different than yours?
You're getting what I said wrong, Jensen. When most people get into a patch of poison ivy, they blister and itch. Some rare people don't. That doesn't mean the poison ivy doesn't exist, or more to the point, that its existence depends on whether or not we think it's there.
Jensen pulled him even closer.
Are you so sure? Richard, you don't know what it's like to be different than everyone else. To not see and feel what they do. You say there's magic, but I can't see it or feel it. It doesn't touch me. Am I to believe you on faith when my senses say it doesn't exist? Maybe because of that I can understand a little better what Owen means. Maybe he doesn't have it all wrong. It makes a person wonder what's real and what's not, and if, like he says, it's only your own point of view.
The information our senses give us must be taken in context. If I close my eyes, the sun doesn't stop shining. When I go to sleep, I'm consciously unaware of anything. That doesn't mean that the world ceases to exist. You have to use the information from your senses in context along with what you've learned to be true about the nature of things. Things don't change because of the way we think about them. What is, is.
But like he says, if we don't experience something with our own senses, then how can we know it's real?
Richard folded his arms. I can't get pregnant, so would you argue that for me women don't exist?
Jensen backed away, looking a little sheepish.
I guess not. Now, Richard said, turning back to Owen, you poisoned me. You admit that much. He tapped his fist against his own chest. It hurts in here. That's real. You caused it. I want to know why, and I want to know why you brought the antidote. I'm not interested in what you think of the camp where the men who attacked us lay dead. Confine yourself to the matter at hand. You brought the antidote for the poison you gave me. That can't be the end of it. What's the rest?
Well, Owen stammered. I didn't want you to die. That's why I saved you.
Stop telling me your feelings about what you did and tell me instead what you did and why. Why poison me and why then save me? I want the answer to that and I want the truth. Owen glanced around at the grim faces watching him. He took a breath, as if to gather his composure.
I needed your help. I had to convince you to help me. I asked before for your help and you refused. Even though my people have great need, I begged. I told you how important it was for them to have your help. But you still said no.
I have my own problems I must deal with, Richard said. I'm sorry the Order invaded your homeland. I know how terrible that is, but I told you I'm trying to bring them down, and our doing so will only help you and your people in your effort to rid yourselves of them. You aren't the only one who has had their home invaded by those brutes. We have men of the Order murdering our loved ones as well.
You must help us first, Owen insisted. You and those like you, the unenlightened ones, must free my people. We can't do it ourselves. We are not savages. I heard what you all had to say about eating meat. Such talk made me ill. Our people are not like that. We can't be, because we are enlightened. I saw how you murdered all those men back there. I need you to do that to the Order.
I thought that wasn't real. Owen ignored the question.
You must give my people freedom.
I already told you I can't.
Now you must.
He looked at Kara, Jensen, Tom, and Friedrich. His gaze settled on Kalin.
You must see to it that Lord Rawl does this or he will die. I have poisoned him.
Kalin seized Owen's shirt. You brought him the antidote to the poison? Owen nodded.
That first night, when I told you all of my great need, I had just given him the poison.
His gaze returned to Richard. You had just drunk it, within hours. Had you agreed to give my people the freedom they need, I would have given you the antidote then, and you would be free of the poison. It would have cured you. But you refused to come with me, to help those who cannot help themselves, as is your duty to those in need. You sent me away, so I did not offer you the antidote. In the time since the poison has worked its way through your body, had you not been selfish, you would have been cured back then. Instead, the poison is now established in you, doing its work. Since it was so long since you drank the poison, the antidote I had with me was no longer enough to cure you, only to make you better for a while.
And what will cure me? Richard asked. You will have to have more of the antidote to rid you of the rest of the poison, and I don't suppose you have any more.
Owen shook his head.
You must give my people freedom. Only then will you be able to get more of the antidote.
Richard wanted to shake the answers out of the man. Instead, he took a breath, trying to stay calm so that he could understand the truth of what Owen had done and then think of the solution.
Why only then? He asked. Because, Owen said, the antidote is in the place taken by the Imperial Order. You must rid us of the invaders if you are to be able to get to the antidote. If you want to live, you must give us our freedom. If you don't, you will die.
Chapter 23. Kalin reached in to seize Owen by the throat. She wanted to strangle him, to choke him, to make him feel the desperate, panicked need of breath that Richard had endured, to make him suffer, to show him what it was like. Kara went for Owen as well, apparently having the same thought as Kalin. Richard thrust his arm out, holding them both back. Holding Owen's shirt in his other fist, Richard shook the man. And how long do I have until I get sick again? How long do I have to live before your poison kills me? Owen's confused gaze flitted from one angry face to another.
But if you do as I ask, as is your duty, you will be fine, I promise. You saw that I brought you the antidote. I don't wish to harm you. That is not my intent, I swear.
Kalin could only think of Richard in crushing pain, unable to breathe. It had been terrifying. She couldn't think of anything else but him going through it again, only this time, never to wake.
How long? Richard repeated.
But if you only...
How long?
Owen licked his lips.
Not a month. Close to it, but not a month, I believe.
Kaylin tried to push Richard away. Let me have him, I'll find out.
No!
Kara pulled Kaylin back.
Mother Confessor, she whispered.
Let Lord Rawl do as he must. You don't know what your touch would do to one such as he.
It might do nothing, Kaylin insisted.
But it might still work, and then we can find out everything. Kara restrained her with an arm around her waist that Kaylin could not pry off.
And if only the subtractive side works and it kills him?
Kaylin stopped struggling as she frowned at Kara.
And since when have you taken up the study of magic?
Since it might harm Lord Rawl.
Kara pulled Kaylin back farther away from Richard.
I have a mind too, you know. I can think things through. Are you using your head? Where is this city? Where is the antidote within the city? What will you do if using your power kills this man and you are the one who condemns Lord Rawl to death when you could have had the information we needed had you not touched him? If you want, I will break his arms. I will make him bleed. I will make him scream in agony. But I will not kill him. I will keep him alive so that he can give us the information we need to rid Lord Rawl of this death sentence. Ask yourself, do you really want to do this because you believe it will gain you the answers we need, or because you want to lash out, to strike out at him? Lord Rawl's life may hang on your being truthful with yourself.
Kaylin panted from the effort of the struggle, but more from her rage. She wanted to lash out, to strike back, just as Kara said, to do whatever she could to save Richard and to punish his attacker.
I've had it with this game, Kaylin said. I want to hear the story, the whole story.
So do I, Richard said.
He lifted the man by his shirt and slammed him down atop the crate.
All right, Owen, no more excuses for why you did this or that. Start at the beginning and tell us what happened and what you and your people did about it.
Owen sat trembling like a leaf. Jensen urged Richard back.
You are frightening him, she whispered to Richard. Give him some room, or he will never be able to get it out.
Richard took a purging breath as he acknowledged Jensen's words with a hand on her shoulder. He walked off a few paces, standing with his hands clasped behind his back, as he stared off in the direction of the sunrise, toward the mountains Kaylin had so often seen him studying. It had been on the other side of the range of the smaller, closer mountains, tight in the shadows of those massive peaks thrusting up through the iron-gray clouds, where they had found the warning beacon and first encountered the black-tipped races. The clouds that capped the sky all the way to the wall of those distant peaks hung heavy and dark. For the first time since Kaylin could remember, it looked like a storm might be upon them. The expectant smell of rain quickened the air.
Where are you from? Richard asked in a calm voice.
Owen cleared his throat as he straightened his shirt and light coat, as if rearranging his dignity. He remained seated atop the crate.
I lived in a place of enlightenment, in a civilization of advanced culture, a great empire.
Where is this noble empire? Richard asked, still staring off into the distance.
Owen stretched his neck up, looking east. He pointed at the far wall of towering peaks where Richard was looking.
There. Do you see that notch in the high mountains? I lived past there in the empire beyond those mountains.
Kaylin remembered asking Richard if he thought they could make it over those mountains. Richard had been doubtful about it.
He looked back over his shoulder. What's the name of this empire?
Bandakar, Owen said in a reverent murmur.
He smoothed his blonde hair to the side, as if to make himself a respectable representative of his homeland.
I was a citizen of Bandakar, of the Bandakaran Empire.
Richard had turned and was staring at Owen in a most peculiar manner.
Bandakar. Do you know what that name Bandakar means?
Owen nodded.
Yes. Bandakar is an ancient word from a time long forgotten. It means the chosen, as in the chosen empire.
Richard seemed to have lost a little of his color. When his eyes met Kaylin's, she could see that he knew very well what the word meant, and Owen had it wrong. Richard seemed to suddenly remember himself.
He rubbed his brow and thought, "Do you, do any of your people, know the language that this ancient word Bandakar is from?" Owen gestured dismissively. "We don't know of the language. It's long forgotten. Only the meaning of this word has been passed down because it's so important to our people to hold on to the heritage of its meaning. Chosen Empire. We are the chosen people." Richard's demeanor had changed. His anger seemed to have faded away. He stepped closer to Owen and spoke softly. "The Bandakaran Empire. Why isn't it known? Why does no one know of your people?" Owen looked away, toward the east, seeing his distant homeland through wet eyes. "It is said that the Ancient Ones, the ones who gave us this name, wanted to protect us, because we are a special people. They took us to a place where no one could go because of the mountains all around, such mountains as only the Creator could impose to close off the land beyond, so that we are protected." "Except that one place," Richard gestured east. "That notch in the mountain range, that pass." "Yes," Owen admitted, still staring off toward his homeland. "That was how we entered the land beyond, our land, but others could enter there as well. It was the one place where we were vulnerable. You see, we are an enlightened people who have risen above violence, but the world is still full of savage races. So those ancient people who wanted our advanced culture to survive, to thrive without the brutality of the rest of the world, they sealed the pass."
"And your people have been isolated for all this time, for thousands of years?"
"Yes. We have a perfect land, a place of an advanced culture that is undisturbed by the violence of the people out here."
"How was the pass, the notch in the mountain, how was it sealed?"
Owen looked at Richard, somewhat startled by the question. He thought it over for a moment.
"Well, the pass was sealed. It was a place that no one could enter."
"Because they would die if they entered this boundary."
With an icy wave of understanding, Kalin suddenly understood what composed the seal to this empire.
"Oh, well, yes," Owen stammered.
"But it had to be that way to keep outsiders from invading our empire. We reject violence unconditionally. It's unenlightened behavior. Violence only invites ever more violence, spiraling into a cycle of violence with no end."
He fidgeted with the worry of such a trap catching them up in the allure of its wicked spell.
"We are an advanced race, above the violence of our ancestors. We have grown beyond, but without the boundary that seals that pass, and until the rest of the world rejects violence as we have, our people could be the prey of unenlightened savages."
"And now that seal is broken."
Owen stared at the ground, swallowing before he spoke.
"Yes."
"How long ago did the boundary fail?"
"We aren't sure. It is a dangerous place. No one lives near it, so we can't be positive, but we believe it was close to 2 years ago."
Kalin felt the dizzying burden of confirmation of her fears. When Owen looked up, he was a picture of misery.
"Our empire is now naked to unenlightened savages."
"Sometime after the boundary came down, the Imperial Order came in through the pass?"
"Yes."
"The land beyond those snow-capped mountains, the Empire of Bandakar, is where the black-tipped races are from, isn't it?" Richard said. Owen looked up, surprised that Richard knew this.
"Yes. Those awful creatures, innocent though they are of malice, prey on the people of my homeland. We must stay indoors at night when they hunt. Even so, people, especially children, are sometimes surprised and caught by those fearsome creatures."
"Why don't you kill them?"
Kara asked indignantly.
"Fight them off. Shoot them with arrows, dear spirits. Why don't you bash their heads in with a rock if you have to?"
Owen looked shocked by the very suggestion.
"I told you, we are above violence. It would be even more wrong to commit violence on such innocent creatures. It is our duty to preserve them, since it is we who entered into their domain. We are the ones who bear the guilt because we entice them into such behavior which is only natural to them. We preserve virtue only by embracing every aspect of the world without the prejudice of our flawed human views."
Richard gave Kara a stealthy gesture to be quiet. "Was everyone in the Empire peaceful?" he asked, pulling Owen's attention away from Kara.
"Yes."
"Weren't there occasionally those who, I don't know, misbehaved, children, for example? Where I come from, children can sometimes become rowdy."
Children, where you come from, must sometimes be rowdy, too.
Owen shrugged a bit with one shoulder.
Well, yes, I guess so. There were times when children misbehave and become unruly.
And what do you do with such children?
Owen cleared his throat, plainly uncomfortable.
Well, they are put out of their home for a time.
Put out of their home for a time, Richard repeated. He lifted his arms in a questioning shrug.
The children I know will usually be happy to be put outside. They simply go play.
Owen shook his head emphatically at the serious nature of the matter.
We are different. From the time we are born, we are together with others. We are all very close. We depend on one another. We cherish one another. We spend all our waking hours with others. We cook and wash and work together. We sleep in a sleeping house together. Ours is an enlightened life of human contact, human closeness. There is no higher value than being together.
So? Richard asked, feigning a puzzled look. When one of you, a child, is put out, that is a cause of unhappiness?
Owen swallowed as a tear ran down his cheek.
There could be nothing worse. To be put out, to be closed off from others, is the worst horror we can endure. To be forced out into the cold cruelty of the world is a nightmare.
Just talking about such a punishment, thinking about it, was making Owen start to tremble.
And that's when sometimes the races get such children, Richard said in a compassionate tone,
when they're alone and vulnerable.
With the back of his hand, Owen wiped the tear from his cheek.
When a child must be put out to be punished, we take all possible precautions. We never put them out at night because that is when the races usually hunt. Children are put out for punishment only in the day. But when we are away from others, we are vulnerable to all the terrors and cruelties of the world. To be alone is a nightmare.
We would do anything to avoid such punishment. Any child who misbehaves and is put out for a while will not likely misbehave again anytime soon. There is no greater joy than to finally be welcomed back in with our friends and family.
So for your people, banishment is the greatest punishment?
Owen stared into the distance.
Of course.
Where I come from, we all got along pretty well, too. We enjoyed each other's company and had great fun when many people would gather. We valued our times together. When we're away for a time, we inquire about all the people we know and haven't seen in a while.
Owen smiled expectantly.
Then you understand.
Richard nodded, returning the smile.
But occasionally, there will be someone who won't behave, even when they're an adult. We try everything we can, but sometimes someone does something wrong, something they know is wrong. They might lie or steal. Even worse, at times someone will deliberately hurt another person, beat someone when robbing them, or rape a woman, or even murder someone.
Owen wouldn't look up at Richard. He stared at the ground.
As he spoke, Richard paced slowly before the man.
When someone does something like that where you come from, Owen, what do your people do? How do an enlightened people handle such horrible crimes some of your people commit against others?
We attack the root cause of such behavior from the beginning,
Owen was quick to answer.
We share all we have to make sure that everyone has what they need so that they don't have to steal. People steal because they feel the hurt of others acting superior. We show these people that we are no better than they, and so they need not harbor such fear of others. We teach them to be enlightened and reject all such behavior.
Richard shrugged nonchalantly. Kalin would have thought that he would be ready to strangle the answers out of Owen, but instead he was behaving in a calm, understanding manner.
She had seen him act this way before. He was the seeker of truth, rightfully named by the first wizard himself.
Richard was doing what seekers did, find the truth. Sometimes he used his sword, sometimes words.
Even though this was the way Richard often disarmed people when he questioned them, in this case it struck Kalin that such a manner was precisely what Owen would be most accustomed to, most comfortable with. This gentle manner was pulling answers from the man and filling in a lot of information Kalin had never thought of trying to get. She had already learned that she was the cause of what had befallen these people.
We both know, Owen, that, try as we might, such efforts to change people's ways don't always work.
Some people won't change. There are times when people do evil things. Even among civilized people, there are some who will not behave in a civil manner despite all your best efforts. What's worse is that if allowed to continue, these few jeopardize the whole community. After all, if you have a rapist among you, you can't allow him to continue to prey on women. If a man committed murder, you wouldn't allow such a man to threaten the empire with his ways, now could you? An advanced culture especially can't be faulted for wanting to stop such dangers to enlightened people. But you've shunned all forms of violence, so you can hardly punish such a man physically. You couldn't put a murderer to death, not if you've truly rejected violence unconditionally. What do you do with such men? How does an enlightened people handle grave problems such as murder? Owen was sweating. It seemed not to have occurred to him to deny the existence of murderers. Richard had already led him past that, had already established the existence of such men. Before Owen could think to object, Richard was already beyond to the next step. "Well," Owen said, swallowing, "as you say, we are an enlightened people. If someone does something to harm another, they are given a denunciation." "A denunciation. You mean you condemn their actions, but not the man? You give him a second chance?" "Yes, that's right." Owen wiped sweat from his brow as he glanced up at Richard. "We work very hard to reform people who make such mistakes and are given a denunciation. We recognize that their actions are a cry for help, so we counsel them in the ways of enlightenment in order to help them to see that they are hurting all our people when they hurt one, and that since they are one of our beloved people, they are only hurting themselves when they hurt another. We show such people compassion and understanding." Kaelin caught Kara's arm and with a stern look convinced her to remain silent. Richard paced slowly before Owen, nodding, as if he thought that sounded reasonable. "I understand. You put a great deal of effort into making them see that they can never do such a thing again." Owen nodded, relieved that Richard understood. "But then there are times when one of those who has received a denunciation and has been counseled to the very best of your ability goes out and does the same crime again, or one even worse. It's clear then that he refuses to be reformed and that he's a threat to public order, safety, and confidence. Left to his own devices, such a person by himself will bring the very thing you unconditionally reject, violence, to stalk among your people and win others to his ways." A light mist had begun to fall. Owen sat on the crate, trembling, frightened, alone. Only a short time ago, he had been reluctant to answer even the most basic question in a meaningful way. Now Richard had him speaking openly. Friedrich stroked the jaw of one of the horses as he quietly watched. Jensen sat on a rock, Betty lying at her feet. Tom stood behind Jensen, a hand resting gently on her shoulder, but keeping an eye on the man Kaelin had touched with her power. That man sat off to the side, listening dispassionately as he waited to be commanded. Kara stood beside Kaelin, ever watchful for trouble, but obviously caught up in the unfolding story of Owen's homeland, even if she was having a hard time holding her tongue. For her part, Kaelin, while she could sympathize with Kara's difficulty in holding her tongue, was transfixed by the tale of a mysterious empire that Richard casually, effortlessly, drew from this man who had poisoned him. She couldn't imagine where Richard was going with his matter-of-fact questions. What did this empire's forms of punishment have to do with Richard being poisoned? It was clear to her, though, that Richard knew where he was headed, and that the path he was following was wide and sunlit. Richard paused before Owen. "What do you do in those instances, when you can't reform someone who has become a danger to everyone? What do an enlightened people do with that kind of person?" Owen spoke in a soft voice that carried clearly in the misty early morning hush. "We banish them."
"Banish them? You mean you send them out into the boundary?"
Owen nodded.
"But you said that going into the boundary is death. You couldn't simply send them into the boundary, or you would be executing them. You must have a place to send them through, a special place, a place where you can banish them without killing them, but a place where you know they can never return to harm your people." Owen nodded again.
Yes, there is such a place. The pass that is blocked by the boundary is steep and treacherous, but there is a path that leads down into the boundary. Those ancient ones who protected us by placing that boundary placed the path as well. The path is said to allow passage out. Because of the way the mountain descends, it is a difficult path, but it can be followed.
And just because of how difficult it is, it's not possible to climb back up? To enter the Bandakaran Empire? Owen chewed his lower lip.
It goes down through a terrible place, a narrow passageway through the boundary, a lifeless land, where it is said that death itself lies to each side. The person banished is given no water or food. He must find his own on the other side or perish. We place watchers at the entrance of the path, where they wait to be sure that the one banished has gone through and is not lingering in the boundary, only to return. The watchers wait and watch for several weeks to be sure that the one banished has gone beyond in search of water and food, in search of his new life away from his people. Once beyond, the forest is a terrible place, a frightening place, with roots that descend over the edge, like a land of snakes. The path takes you down under that cascade of roots and running water. Then, even lower, you find yourself in a strange land where the trees are far above, reaching for the distant light. But you see only their roots twisting and stretching down into the darkness toward the ground. It is said that once you have seen that forest of roots towering all around you, you have made it through the boundary and the pass through the mountains. There is said to be no way to enter our land from that other side, to use the pass to return to our empire. Once banished, there is no redemption.
Richard moved up close beside Owen and placed a hand on his shoulder.
What did you do to be banished, Owen?
Owen sank forward, putting his face in his hands as he finally broke down, sobbing. Chapter 24. Richard left his hand on Owen's shoulder as he spoke in a compassionate tone.
Tell me what happened, Owen. Tell me in your own way.
Kaelin was startled to hear, after all Owen had said, that he had become one of the banished. She saw Jensen's jaw fall open. Kara lifted an eyebrow. Kaelin could see that Richard's hand on Owen's shoulder was an emotional lifeline for the man. He finally sat up, sniffling back the tears. He wiped his nose on his sleeve. He looked up at Richard.
Should I tell you the whole story? All of it?
Yes, I'd like to hear it all from the beginning. Kaelin was struck at how much Richard reminded her at that moment of his grandfather Zed, and the way Zed always wanted to hear the whole story.
Well, I was happy among my people, with them all around me. They held me to their breast when I was young. I was always safe in their welcoming arms. While I knew of other children who became unruly and were put out as punishment, I never did anything to be put out. I hungered to learn to be like my people. They taught me the ways of enlightenment. For a time I served my people as the wise one. Later my people were pleased with how enlightened I was, how I embraced them all, and so they made me the speaker of our town. I traveled to nearby towns to speak the words of what the people of my town all believed as one. I went to our great cities for the same reason. I was always happiest, though, when I was home with my closest people. I fell in love with a woman from my town. Her name is Marilee.
Owen stared off into his memories. Richard didn't rush him, but waited patiently until he began again at his own pace.
It was spring, a little more than 2 years ago, when we fell joyfully in love. Marilee and I spent time talking, holding hands, and when we could, sitting together while among the others. Among all the others, though, I only had eyes for Marilee. She only had eyes for me. When we were with others, it felt like we were alone in the world, Marilee and I, and the world belonged to us alone, that only we had the eyes to see all its hidden beauty. It is wrong to feel this way. To be so alone in our hearts is to be selfish, and to think our eyes can see so clearly is sinful pride. But we could not help ourselves. The trees blossomed just for us. The water in the streams burbled their music just for us. The moon rose for us alone.
Owen slowly shook his head.
You could not understand how it was, how we felt.
I understand quite well how it was, Richard assured him in a quiet voice. Owen glanced up at Richard. Then his gaze moved to Kaylin. She nodded to him that it was so. His brow twitched with wonder. He looked away then, perhaps Kaylin thought, in guilt.
Well, Owen said, going back to his story, I was the speaker of our town, the one who speaks what all decide that must be decided as being true. I also sometimes helped other people resolve questions of what is right according to the tenets of an advanced culture. Owen flicked his hand in a self-conscious manner. As I said, I once served my people as the wise one, so people trusted me.
Richard just nodded, not interrupting, even though Kaylin knew that he didn't quite understand the meaning of many of the details of what Owen was saying, any more than she did. The gist of the story, though, was becoming all too clear.
I asked Marilee if she would be my wife, if she would marry me and no other. She said that it was the happiest day of her life to be asked by me. For I said I wanted no other but her. It was the happiest day of my life when she said she would have me as her husband. Everyone was very pleased. Everyone loved us both and kept us sheltered in their arms for a long time to show their joy. As we sat together with everyone, we all talked about the plans for the wedding and how much we would all be pleased that Marilee and I would be husband and wife and bring children among our people.
Owen stared off in his thoughts. It seemed that he might have forgotten that he'd stopped speaking. So, was it a grand wedding? Richard finally prompted. Owen still stared off.
The men of the order came. That was when we first realized that the seal that had protected our people since the beginning times had failed. There was no longer a barrier protecting us. Our empire was now naked to savages.
Kaylin knew that what she had done had caused the boundary to fail, resulting in these people being defenseless. She had had no choice, but that didn't make it any easier to listen to.
They came to our town where I was speaker. Our town, like others, has walls all around. Those who gave us our name, Bandakar, proclaimed the town should be built such as this. It was wise of them to tell us this. The walls protect us from the beasts of the forest, make us safe without having to harm any creatures. The men of the order set up camp outside our walls. There was really no place for them to stay in the town. We have no accommodations to house so many people because we never have great numbers of visitors from other towns. Worse, I was fearful of having such men as they looked sleeping under our roof with us. It was wrong to have such fear. It is my failing, not theirs, I know, but I had the fear. Since I was the speaker for my town, I went out to their camp with food and offerings. I was filled with my sinful failing of being afraid of them. They were big, some with long, dark, greasy, tangled hair, some with shaved heads, many with filthy beards of coarse hair, none of them with fair, sun-golden hair like our people. It was shocking to see them wearing hides of animals, leather plates, chains and metal, and straps with sharp studs. Hanging on their belts, they all carried vicious-looking implements, the likes of which I had never in my life imagined, but which I later learned were weapons. I told these strange men that they were welcome to share what we had, that we would honor them. I told them that they were invited to sit with us, to share their words with us.
Everyone waited in silence, not wanting to say a word as tears ran down Owen's face and dripped off his jaw.
The men of the order did not sit with us. They did not share their words with us. Though I spoke to them, they acted as if I were not worthy of their recognition, other than to grin at me, as if they intended to eat me. I sought to allay their fears, since it is the fear of others that causes hostility. I assured the men that we were peaceful and intended them no ill will. I told them that we would do our best to accommodate them among us. The man who was their speaker, a commander, he called himself, spoke to me then. He told me that his name was Luchan. His shoulders were twice as wide as mine, even though he was no taller than me. This man, Luchan, said he did not believe me. I was horrified to hear this. He said that he thought my people meant him harm. He accused us of wishing to kill his men.
I was shaken that he would think such a thing of us, especially after I had told him of our open welcome to his men. I was shaken to know that I had done something to cause him to feel we were threatening to him and his men. I assured him of our desire to be peaceful with them. Lu Chan smiled at me then. Not a smile of happiness, not a smile like I had ever seen before. He said they were going to burn down our town and kill all the people in it to prevent us from attacking his men as they slept. I begged him to believe our peaceful ways, to sit with us and share his worries, and we would do what we needed to do to dispel such doubts and show him our love of him for being our fellow man. Lu Chan said then that he would not burn down our town and kill us all upon a condition, as he called it. He said that if I would surrender my woman to him as a token of my sincerity and goodwill, he would then believe our words. He said that if, on the other hand, I failed to send her out to him, what happened would be my fault, would be on my head, for not cooperating with them, for not showing my sincerity and goodwill toward them. I went back to hear the words of my people. Everyone agreed and said that I must do this, that I must send Marilee out to the men of the order, so that they would not burn down our town and murder everyone. I asked them not to decide so quickly and offered the idea that we could close the gates in the wall to keep the men from coming in and harming us. My people said that men such as these would find a way to break the wall, and then they would murder everyone for shutting our gates and shaming them with our bigotry toward them. The people all spoke up loudly that I must show the man Lu Chan goodwill and our peaceful intent, that I must allay his fears of us. I never felt so alone among my people. I could not go against the word of everyone, for it is taught that only the voices of people joined together in one voice can be wise enough to know the true way. No one person can know what is right. Only consensus can make a thing right. My knees trembled as I stood before Marilee. I heard myself ask if she wished me to do as the men wanted, as our people wanted. I told her that I would run away with her if she would wish it. She wept as she said that she would not hear such sinful talk from me, for it would mean the death of everyone else. She said that she must go to the men of the order to appease them, or there would be violence. She told me that she would tell them of our peaceful ways and thus gentle them toward us. I was proud of Marilee for upholding the highest values of our people. I wanted to die for being proud of such a thing as would take her from me. I kissed Marilee a last time, but I could not stop my tears. I held her in my arms and we wept together. Then I took her out to the man who was their commander, Lu Chan. He had a thick black beard, a shaved head, and a ring through one ear and one nostril. He said that I had made a wise choice. His sun-darkened arms were nearly as big around as Marilee's waist. His big, filthy hand took Marilee by her arm and bore her away with him as he turned back and told me to scurry back to my town, to my people. His men laughed at me as they watched me go back up the road. The men of the order left my town and my people alone. We had peace I had purchased with Marilee. I had no peace in my heart. For a time the men of the order were gone from our town. They returned then one afternoon and called for me to come out. I asked Lu Chan about Marilee, if she was happy, if she was well. Lu Chan turned his head and spat, then said he didn't know, that he never asked her. I was worried and asked if she spoke with him of our peaceful ways, assured him of our innocent intent toward him. He said that when he was with women, he wasn't much interested in them for their talking. He winked at me, though I had never seen anyone wink in such a fashion. I knew his meaning. I was very frightened for Marilee, but I reminded myself that nothing is real, that I could not really know anything from what I was hearing. I was only hearing what this one man said of things as he saw them, and I knew that I was only sensing part of the world. I could not know reality from my eyes and ears alone. Lu Chan said then that I should open the town gates lest they think we were acting in a hostile way toward them. Lu Chan said that if we failed to do as he asked, it would begin a cycle of violence. I went back and spoke his words to all the people gathered around me. My people all spoke in one voice,
and said that we must open the gates and invite them in to prove that we held no hostility, no prejudice toward the men. The men of the order came in through those gates we let stand wide for them, and seized nearly all the women, from those still the age of girls to grandmothers. I stood with the other men, begging them to leave our women be, to leave us be. I told them that we had agreed to their demands to prove to them that we meant them no harm, but it did no good. They would not listen. I told Lu Chan then that I had sent Marilee to him as his condition for peace. I told him that they must honor their agreement. Lu Chan and his men laughed. I cannot say if what I saw then was real. Reality is in the realm of fate, and we, in this place we think we know as the world, cannot know it in full truth. That day fate swept down on my people. We had no say in it. We know that we must not fight against fate, for it has already been foreordained by the true reality we cannot see. I watched as our women were dragged away. I watched, unable to do anything, as they screamed our names, as they reached out for us, as the hands of those big men held our women and bore them away from us. I had never heard such screams as I heard that day. The overcast seemed as if it would soon brush the tops of the trees. In the thick silence, Kalin heard a bird in the bristlecone pine singing. Owen was alone, off in his solitary world of terrible memories. Richard stood, arms folded, watching the man, but saying nothing. I went to other towns, Owen finally said. In a couple of places the order had been there before me. The men of the order did much the same to those towns as they had done to my town. They took the women. In some places they also took a few men. In other places I went the order had not yet come. As the speaker of my town, I told them of what had befallen my town, and I urged others to do something. They were angry with me and said it was wrong to resist, that to resist was to give in to violence, to become no better than the savages. They urged me to renounce my outspoken ways and to heed the wisdom of the joined voices of our people that had brought enlightenment and thousands of years of peace. They told me that I was only looking at events through my limited eyes and not the better judgment of the group. I went then to one of our important cities and told them again that the seal on the pass was broken and that the imperial order was upon us and that something must be done. I urged them to listen to me and to consider what we could do to protect our people. Because I was so inconsiderately assertive, the assembly of speakers took me to the wise one so that I might have his counsel. It is a great honor to have the words of the wise one. The wise one told me that I must forgive those who had done these things against my people if we were to end the violence. The wise one said that the anger and hostility shown by the men of the order was a mark of their inner pain, a cry for help, and they must be shown compassion and understanding. I should have been humbled by such clear wisdom as could only come from the wise one. But instead I spoke out of my wish for Marilee and all the other people to be returned from such men, and for the speakers to help me in this. The wise one said that Marilee would find her own happiness without me, and that I was guilty of selfishness for wanting to keep her for myself. He said that fate had come for the other people, and it was not my place to make demands of fate. I asserted to the speakers and the wise one that the men of the order had not upheld the agreement made by Lu Chan for Marilee to be sent to them. The wise one said that Marilee had acted properly by going in peace to the men, so that the cycle of violence would end. He said that it was selfish and sinful for me to put my wants above peace she selflessly worked toward, and that my attitude toward them was probably what had provoked the men to anger. I asked what I was to do, when I had acted honestly, but they had not. The wise one said that I was wrong to condemn men I did not know, men I had not first forgiven or tried to embrace, or even to understand. He said that I must encourage them in the ways of peace by throwing myself before them and begging them to forgive me for acting in such a way that kindled their inner pain by reminding them of past wrongs done to them. I told the wise one then, in front of all the other speakers, that I did not want to forgive these men or to embrace these men, but that I wanted to cast them out of our lives. I was given a denunciation. Richard handed Owen a cup of water, but said nothing.
Owen sipped at the water without saying it.
The gathering of speakers commanded me to go back to my town and seek the advice of those among whom I lived, commanding that I ask my people to counsel me back to our ways. I went back intending to redeem myself, only to discover that it had become worse than before. Now the order had returned to take whatever they wanted from the town, food and goods. We would have given them whatever they wanted, but they never asked. They just took. More of our men had been taken away, too, some of the boys and some of those who were young and strong. Other men, who had in some way offended the dignity of the men of the order, had been murdered. People I knew stood staring with empty eyes at blood where our friends had died. In other such places, people gathered to mound remembrances over the blood. These places had become sacred shrines, and people knelt there to pray. The children would not stop crying. No one would counsel me. Everyone in my town trembled behind doors, but they cast their eyes down and opened those doors when the men of the order knocked, lest we offend them. I could not stand to be in our town any longer. I ran to the country, even though I was terrified that I would be alone. There in the hills I found other men, selfish as I, hiding in fear for their lives. Together we decided to try to do something, to try to bring an end to the misery. We resolved to restore peace. At first we sent representatives to speak with the men of the order, to let them know that we meant them no harm, and that we only sought peace with them, and to ask what we could do to satisfy them. The men of the order hung these men by their ankles from poles at the edge of our town and skinned them alive. I knew these men all my life, these men who had counseled me, advised me, broken fasts with me, sheltered me in their arms with joy when I told them merrily and I wanted to be wed. The men of the order left these poor men to hang by their ankles as they screamed in agony in the hot summer sun, where the black-tipped races came and found them. I reminded myself that what I saw that day was not real, and that I should not believe such sights, that possibly my eyes were deceiving me as punishment for having improper thoughts, and that my mind could not possibly know if this sight was real or an illusion. Not every man that had gone to speak with the men of the order was killed. A few of our men were sent back to us with word from the order. They said that if we did not come down out of the hills and return to their rule in our town, to show that we did not intend to attack them, then they would begin skinning a dozen people a day and hanging them on poles for the races until either we returned to demonstrate our peaceful intent or until every last person left in the town was skinned alive. Many of our men wept, unable to stand to think that they would be the cause of a cycle of violence. So they went back to the town to show that they intended no harm. Not all of us went back. A few of us remained in the hills. Since most returned, and the order had no count of us, they thought all had complied with their command. Those few of us who were left in the hills, living off the nuts, fruits, and berries we could find, or the food we snuck back and stole, we slowly gathered together supplies to see us through. I told the other men with me that we should find out what the order was doing with our people they had taken away. Since the men of the order didn't know us, we could sometimes mingle in with people working the fields or tending to animals and sneak back into town without the order knowing who we were, without knowing that we were the men from the hills. Over the next months, we followed and watched the men of the order. The children had been sent away, but the men of the order had taken all the women to a place they built, an encampment, they called it, that they fortified against attack. Owen put his face in his hands again as he spoke through sobs. They were using our women as breeding stock. They sought to have them bear children, as many children as they could birth, children of their soldiers. Some women were already pregnant. Most of those who weren't already pregnant became pregnant. Over the next year and a half, many children were born. They were nursed for a time, and then they were all sent away as their mothers were gotten pregnant again. I don't know where these children were taken, somewhere beyond our empire. The men who had been taken from the town were also taken away beyond our empire. The men of the order did not watch their captives well, since our people shunned violence, so a couple of men escaped and ran to the hills where they found us.
They told us that the order had taken them to see the women, and told them that if they did not do as they were told, if they did not follow all the orders they were given, then all these women before them would die, that they would be skinned alive. These men who escaped did not know where they were to be taken, or what it was they were to do, only that if they did not follow the instructions given them, then they would be the cause of the violence to our women. After a year and a half of hiding, of meeting with others, we learned that the order had spread to other places in our empire, taken other towns and cities. The wise one was taken into hiding. We discovered that some towns and cities had invited the order to come in, to be among them in an attempt to appease them and keep them from doing harm. No matter how hard our people tried, their concessions failed to placate the belligerence of the men of the order. We could not understand why this was true. In some of the largest cities, though, it was different. The people there had listened to the speakers of the order and had come to believe that the cause of the imperial order was the same as our cause, to bring an end to abuse and injustice. The order convinced these people that they abhorred violence, that they had been enlightened, as were our people, but they had to turn to violence to defeat those who would oppress us all. They said that they were champions of our people's cause of enlightenment. The people there rejoiced that they were at last in the hands of saviors who would spread our words of enlightenment to the savages who did not yet live by peace. Richard, a thunderstorm building, could hold his tongue no longer. And even after all the brutality, these people believed the words of the imperial order? Owen spread his hands. The people in those places were swayed by the words of the order, that they were fighting for the same ideals as we lived by. They told our people in those cities that they had only acted as they did because my town and some of the other places like it had sided with the savages from the north, with the Daharan Empire. I had heard this name before, the Daharan Empire. During the year and a half that I lived in the hills with the other men, I sometimes traveled out of our land, out into the surrounding places, to see what I could discover that might help us to cast the imperial order out of Bandakar. While I was out of my land, I went to some of the cities in the old world, as I learned it was called. In one place, Alter Rang, I heard whispers of a great man from the north, from the Daharan Empire, who brought freedom. Other of my men also went to other places. When we returned, we all told each other what we had seen, what we had heard. All those who came back told of the same thing, told of hearing of one called Lord Rawl and his wife, the Mother Confessor, who fought the Imperial Order. Then we learned where the Wise One was being kept safe, as were most of our greatest speakers. It was in our greatest city, a place where the Order had not yet come. The Order was busy with other places, and so they were in no hurry. My people were going nowhere. They had nowhere to go. The men who were with me wanted me to be their speaker, to go to talk with these great speakers to convince them that we must do something to stop the imperial order and cast them out of Bandakar. I journeyed to the great city, a place I had never been before, and I was inspired at seeing a place that such a great culture as ours had built, a culture about to be destroyed. If I could not convince these great speakers and the wise one to think of something to do to stop the order, I spoke before them with great urgency. I told them of all the order had done. I told them of the men I had in hiding, waiting for word of what they were to do. The great speakers said that I cannot know the true nature of the order from what I and a few men had seen, that the imperial order was a vast nation and we saw only a tiny speck of their people. They said that men cannot do such cruel acts as I described because it would cause them to shrink back in horror before they could complete them. To prove it, they suggested that I try to skin one of them. I admitted that I could not, but I told them that I had seen the men of the order do this. The speakers scorned my insistence that it was real. They said I must always keep in mind that reality is not for us to know. They said that the men of the imperial order were probably frightened that we might be a violent people, and simply wanted to test our resolve by tricking us into believing that the things I described were real, so that they could see how we reacted, if peace was really our way, or if we would attack them.
The great speaker said then that I could not know if I really saw all the things I said, and that even if I did, I could not judge if they were for the bad or the good, that I was not the person to judge the reasons of men I did not know, that to do so would be to believe that I was above them, and to put myself above them would be an act of prejudiced hostility. I could only think of all the things I had seen of the men with me who all agreed that we must convince the great speakers to act to preserve our empire. I could only see in my mind the face of Luchan. And then I thought of Marilee in the hands of this man. I thought of the sacrifice she had made and how her life was cast away into this horror for nothing. I stood up before the great speakers and screamed that they were evil. Kara snorted a laugh. Seems you can tell what's real when you put your mind to it. Richard shot her a withering glare. Owen glanced up and blinked. His thoughts had been so distant as he told his story that he hadn't really heard her. He looked up at Richard. That was when they banished me, he said. But the boundary seal had failed, Richard said. You had already come and gone through the pass. How could they enforce a banishment with the boundary down? Owen waved dismissively. They do not need the wall of death. Banishment is in a way a sentence of death, the death of the person as a citizen of Bandakar. My name would be known throughout the empire, at least what was left of it, and every person would shun me. I would be turned away from every door. I was one of the banished. No one would want to have any contact with me. I was now an outcast. It does not matter that they could not put me beyond the barrier. They put me beyond my people. That was worse. I went back to my men in the hills to collect my things and confess to them that I had been banished. I was going to go out beyond our homeland, as I had been commanded by the will of our people through our great speakers. But my men, those in the hills, they would not see me go. They said that the banishment was wrong. These men had seen the things I had seen. They had wives, mothers, daughters, sisters who had been taken away. They all had seen their friends murdered, seen the men skinned alive and left to suffer in agony as they died, seen the races come to circle over them as they hung on those poles. They said that since all our eyes had seen these things, then these things must be true, must be real. They all said that we had gone into the hills because we love our land and want to restore the peace we once had. They said that the great speakers were the ones whose eyes did not see, and they were condemning our people to murder at the hands of savage men and those of our people who lived to a cruel life under the rule of the Imperial Order, to be used as breeding stock or as slaves. I was shocked that these men would not reject me for being banished, that they wanted me to stay with them. It was then that we decided that we would be the ones to do something, to come up with the plan we always wanted the speakers to decide. When I asked what would be our plan, everyone said the same thing. They all said that we must get Lord Rawl to come and give us freedom. They all spoke with one voice. We decided then what we would do. Some men said that one such as the Lord Rawl would come to cast out the order when we asked. Others thought you might not be willing, since you are unenlightened, and not of our ways, not of our people. When we considered that possibility, we decided we must have a way to ensure you would have to come, should you refuse us. Since I was banished, I said that it was upon me to do this thing. Except to live in the hills with my men, I could have no life among our people unless we cast out the Imperial Order, and our ways were restored to us. I told the men that I did not know where I could find the Lord Rawl, but that I would not give up until I did so. First, though, one of the men, an older man who had spent his life working with herbs and cures, made me the poison I put into your water skin. He made me the antidote as well. He told me how the poison worked, and how it could be counteracted, since none of us wished to consider that it would come to murder, even of an unenlightened man. By the sidelong look Richard gave her, Kaelin knew that he wanted her to hold her tongue, and knew that she was having difficulty doing so. She redoubled her effort. "I was worried about how I would find you," Owen said to Richard,
but I knew I had to. Before I could go in search of you, though, I had to hide the rest of the antidote, as was our plan. While in a city where the order had won the people to their side, I heard some people at a market say that it was a great honor that the very man who had come to their city was the most important man among all those of the Imperial Order in Bandakar. The thought struck me that this man might know something of the man the order hated most, Lord Rawl. I stayed in the city for several days, watching the place where this man was said to be. I watched the soldiers come and go. I saw that they sometimes took people in with them, and then later the people came back out. One day I saw people come back out, and they did not appear to be harmed, so I made my way very close to them to hear what they might say. I heard them talk that they had seen the great man himself. I could not hear much of what they said of their visit inside, but none said that they were hurt. And then I saw the soldiers come out, and I suspected that they might be going to get more people to take them in to see this great man. So I went before them in a central gathering square. I waited then near the open aisles between the public benches. The soldiers rushed in and gathered up a small crowd of people, and I was swept up with the others. I was terrified of what might happen to me, but I thought this might be my only chance to go in the building with this important man, my only chance to see what he looked like, to see the place where he was, so I could know where to sneak back and listen, as I had learned to do when living in the hills with my men. I had resolved to do this to see if I could learn any information on Lord Rawl. Still, I was trembling with worry when they took us all into the building and down the halls and up the stairs to the top floor. I feared that I was being led to slaughter and wanted to run, but I thought then of my men back in the hills, depending on me to find the Lord Rawl and get him to come to Bandakar and give us freedom. We were taken through a heavy door into a dim room that filled me with fear because it stank of blood. The windows on two walls of the stark room were closed off by shutters. I saw that across the room there was a table with a broad bowl, and nearby a row of fat, sharpened wooden stakes, standing nearly as tall as my chest. They were stained dark with blood and gore. Two women and a man with us fainted. Out of anger, the soldiers kicked them in their heads. When the people did not rise, the soldiers picked up their arms and dragged them away. I saw blood trails smear along the floor behind them. I didn't want to have my head caved in by the boot of one of these gruesome men, so I resolved not to faint. A man swept into the room suddenly like a chill wind. I had not ever been afraid of any man, even Lu Chan, like I was afraid of this man. He was dressed in layer upon layer of cloth strips that flowed out behind as he moved. His jet-black hair was swept back and smoothed with oils that made it glisten. His nose seemed to stick out even more than it would have, had he not slicked back his hair. His small black eyes were rimmed in red. When those beady eyes fixed on me, I had to remind myself that I had vowed not to faint. He peered at each person in turn as he slowly walked past us, as if he were picking out a turnip for dinner. It was then, as his knobby fingers came out from his odd clothes to point in a waving manner at one person and then another, until he had pointed out five people, that I saw that his fingernails were all painted as black as his hair. His hand waved, dismissing the rest of us. The soldiers moved between the five people this man had pointed out and the rest of us. They started pushing us toward the door, but just then, before we could be ushered out, a commander with a nose that had been flattened to the side, as if from being broken repeatedly, came in and said that the messenger had arrived. The man with the black hair ran his black nails back through his black hair and told the commander to tell the messenger to wait, that by morning he would have the latest information. I was then led out and down the stairs along with the rest of the people. We were taken outside and told to go away, that our services wouldn't be needed. The soldiers laughed when they said this. I left with the others, so as not to make the men angry. The people all whispered about having seen the great man himself. I could think only of what the latest information might be. Later, after dark, I sneaked back, and in the rear of the building I discovered behind a gate through a high wooden fence a narrow alleyway. In the dark,
I entered the alley and hid myself inside a doorway entrance to the back hall of the building. There were passageways beyond, and in the candlelight I recognized one passage as the place I had been earlier. It was late, and there was no one in the halls. I moved deeper into the passageways. Rooms and recesses lined each side of the hall. But with the late hour, no one came out. I sneaked up the stairs and crept to the big, thick door to the room where I had been taken. It was there, in that dark hall, before the big door, that I heard the most horrifying cries I have ever heard. People were begging and weeping for their lives, crying for mercy. One woman pleaded endlessly to be put to death to end her suffering. I thought I would vomit or faint, but one thought kept me still and hidden, kept me from running as fast as my legs would carry me. That was the thought that this was the fate of all my people if I did not help them by bringing Lord Rawl. I stayed there all night in a dark recess in a hall across from the big door, listening to those poor people in unimaginable agony. I don't know what the man was doing to them, but I thought I would die of sorrow for their slow suffering. The whole of the night the moans of agony never ceased. I shivered in my hiding place, weeping, and told myself that it wasn't real, that I shouldn't be afraid of what was not real. I imagined the people's pain, but told myself that I was putting my imagination on top of my senses. The very thing I had been taught was wrong. I put my thoughts to Marilee, the times we had been together, and ignored the sounds that were not real. I could not know what was real, what these sounds really were. Early in the morning, the commander I had seen before returned. I peeked carefully out from my dark hiding place. The man with the black hair came to the door. I knew it was him because when his arm came out of the room to hand the man a scrolled paper, I saw his black fingernails. The man with the black hair said to the commander with the flattened, crooked nose, he called him Najari, that he had found them. That's what he said, them. Then he said, they've made it to the east edge of the wasteland and are now heading north. He told the man to give the messenger the orders right away. Najari said, shouldn't be long then, Nicholas, and you will have them, and we'll have the power to name our price. Chapter 25. Richard spun around. Nicholas? You heard him say that name? Owen blinked in surprise. Yes, I'm sure of it. He said Nicholas. Kaelin felt a weary hopelessness settle over her, like the cold, wet mist. Richard gestured urgently. Go on.
Well, I wasn't sure that they were talking about you, about the Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor, when the commander said them. But by the grim excitement in their voices, I had the impression that it was so. Their voices reminded me of the first time the order came, at the way Luchan smiled at me in a way I had never seen before, like he might eat me. I thought that this information was my best chance to find you, so I started out at once.
Born on a light gust, drizzle replaced the morning mist. Kaelin realized that she was shivering with the cold. Richard pointed at the man sitting on the ground not far away, the man with the notch in his right ear, the man Kaelin had touched. Some of the storm within Richard boiled to the surface.